This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava. It's been 6.5 years since the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, and Osama bin Laden is still at large. Steve Call says he thinks he knows, generally speaking, where the 9/11 mastermind has been hiding. Whether Osama bin Laden is found in the mountains of Pakistan near the Afghan border remains to be seen. And while Steve Call cannot precisely predict bin Laden's future, he has laid out a detailed account of his past and that of his family. Call, twice a Pulitzer Prize winner, has a new book titled The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. In it, Call explores how Osama's father, Mohammed bin Laden, became close with the royal family in Saudi Arabia and built a fortune in business, and how that wealth and exposure to Western culture was interpreted differently by Osama and his 53 siblings. Steve Call spoke about the bin Laden family at the Commonwealth Club of California recently, and it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Steve Call is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a former reporter and managing editor at The Washington Post. He is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden. He is also president of the Public Policy Institute, the New America Foundation. And here is Steve Call discussing his latest book, The Bin Ladens, at the Commonwealth Club of California.
I used to read books with titles like The Rockefellers or The Kennedys, these multi-generational sagas of important American families whose progress and diversity told us something about our own country in the 20th century in particular. And it was with those books in mind, after I finished Ghost Wars, that it occurred to me that the bin Ladens offered a chance to write something specific about Saudi Arabia in a similar way. And having come and gone from the kingdom over many years, I had always found it both an inviting and interesting place, but a particularly difficult place to work. It doesn't have the points of entry that researchers and journalists rely upon, a free press or a political opposition. And it's a young society, quite reticent. And it's also a place that's very important in American life today, but one that is usually consigned to a fairly cliched set of understandings dating back to the political cartoons of the 1970s and the greedy oil sheikhs pouring gasoline into our wide-finned automobiles. And so it's always been frustrating, as somebody who knew a little bit about the place, to not really be able to write about it in its complexity and in its fullness. And I think when I first started on this project, that was one of my goals. What I discovered about the bin Ladens, though, is that they are a Saudi story, but they're also very much a story of globalization. And I think that was where the research led me. I wanted, as I dug into it, to try to tell through the prism of a single family a story about global integration and also the limits of global integration in these times. And the bin Ladens, of course, are immigrants to Saudi Arabia, but they come from a very specific place in southern Yemen, the Hadhramout, which is itself a fountainhead of great migration and globalization before we had a term for it. The Hadhramis sailed the high seas in the pre-Islamic period. They became warriors in the earliest Islamic armies. Today, those who trace their roots to this part of Yemen are prominent in the governments of Indonesia and Malaysia and many other societies. In the Islamic world, they're very well known as a diaspora, similar to the overseas Chinese or the Jewish diaspora, very successful, very entrepreneurial, very also aware of one another, self-conscious over many centuries. But in the United States, they're not understood at all. But I think this characteristic of global confidence and a sense of a world without borders, which dates even to the pre-colonial period, is present in the bin Laden story, and it takes us right to 9/11 in a way of thinking, and I'll try to draw some of that out. The other purpose in undertaking this narrative was to try to reinterpret Osama as a member of his own family and to reinterpret him also as a Saudi. I had worked on the subject of Osama bin Laden and his biography for 15 years or more, wrote with a colleague, Steve Levine, at the Washington Post, my first story about Osama bin Laden in the summer of 1993 when he was living in Sudan and was just emerging as a well-heeled nuisance but hadn't really declared war on anybody. And I'd always concentrated on him, as many others have, and for good reason, as a creature of the Afghan wars, as a creature of international Islamic radicalism and the spread of Islamist ideology after 1979 in particular. And he is those things. But he's more than that. And I wanted, in the research for this book, to try to explore these other less accessible spaces of his membership in his own family and his place as it turns out, a rather orthodox Saudi subject. We tend to think of him as a radical. I think one of the themes of his life is his own orthodoxy for many years until he finally breaks from that orthodoxy. So how do you tell this story, a story like the Kennedys or the Rockefellers? Well, of course, it's through characters passing across decades in the context of a family's own narrative, one that we can all identify with, even when the cultural context of the bin Laden family seems quite alien. It still has this universal grammar of families built into it that I think was very powerful in the course of the research. Even when the bin Ladens seemed quite remarkably different from any family I had ever known, at the same time they retained this accessibility and this very powerful sense of belonging as a group, which I'll try to touch upon. I want to give you a taste of the narrative through three characters: Osama's father, Muhammad, his eldest brother, Salim, who ran the family after Muhammad's death, and then finally Osama himself. They're not the only important bin Ladens. They're not the only important bin Ladens in this narrative, but there's a way, I think, to make more specific these themes that I've tried to sketch by talking about each of them. And what I want to suggest is that there is a strain of charismatic genius that runs through these three individuals, starting with the father, and that reaches Osama in a distorted and refracted and ultimately violent guise. But it's present nonetheless. And it really, for me, as someone who spent a lot of time with Osama's biography, it explained him in a way that was new for me. The father, Muhammad bin Laden, was essentially an orphan who was born in this impoverished area of southern Yemen. His own father had been forced to leave the family village because he owed a debt that he couldn't pay. He ended up dying young, leaving little. And as was not entirely unusual for Hadrami orphans of the 1920s or so, Muhammad and his younger brother Abdullah essentially walked out of this canyon where they lived and boarded a sailing ship with referrals to this diaspora that I talked about before, people who knew them as Hadramis and were welcoming them. They sailed to Saudi Arabia, and Muhammad arrived there at just in time for the Great Depression at about 14 or 15 years of age. Between his arrival around the late 1920s, 1930, and the end of the Second World War, he essentially hustled for 15 years. He slept on the sand initially. He worked as a porter. He taught himself to be a mason, a bricklayer. He started a small contracting company. And gradually, he got the feel for how people succeeded in Saudi Arabia. And the answer to that question was one ingratiated oneself with the royal family. And really, that was about the beginning and the end of the proposition. And he managed to build contacts with the Saudi family and their principal retainers during the period as the Second World War ended, when oil wealth finally began to flow into the kingdom in a serious way. Oil, of course, had been discovered by largely American prospectors as in the early 1930s, but the disruption to global commerce caused first by the Depression and then particularly by the Second World War meant that the Saudis really didn't have a lot of money to spend until the late 1940s, mid to late 1940s. And when it came, spend it they did, initially on palaces of every variety and splendor that they could imagine. The Saudi royal family in the 1940s was not a particularly global family. Unlike the bin Ladens, they were not a people who sailed the seas. They were a people of the desert who had never been conquered by any colonial army and who never much left the high desert plateau in central Saudi Arabia where they were predominant. And as they gathered this oil wealth and had all of these American advisors telling them that they were now ready to build a country, an idea that they hadn't sort of fully imagined until the Americans pressed it upon them, their initial instinct was to just make more glorious the rather unimpressive mud palaces in which the royal family had previously lived. And Mohammed bin Laden became their favorite builder. Why? Well, initially, the Americans urged the Saudi royal family to invite in international corporations expert in construction, like Bechtel and others from Britain and Germany. And indeed, these corporations arrived, and they undertook contracts with the Saudi royal family to start building things in the 1940s and the early 1950s. But it turned out that a contract with the Saudi royal family was an unusual proposition for these international construction companies. First of all, working conditions in the kingdom were quite difficult. There were few roads and the weather was extreme. But more problematic were the work habits of their employers. The Bechtel Corporation would be contracted to build something, for instance, a road from the port of Jeddah to the holy city of Mecca. And they would get started on that and roll in some bulldozers and some graders and so on. And about 2 months into the job, the phone would ring and it would be a member of the royal family saying, "My refrigerator's broken. Would you mind coming over and repairing it? And by the way, my cousin seems to have imported an air conditioner. I don't know what that is, but it's from New York and it seems to keep things cool. We'd like one of those." And the managers of these contracts would struggle to accommodate these requests. But when it reached the point, as the archives show in one instance, that a prominent prince called on this very road contract and said, "I need to borrow your grader because I want to dig private gardens at my palace for the next 6 weeks." And gradually, the Bechtel executives in charge of this, Bechtel, I guess is the way you say it, said, "Life is too short." And they basically said, you know, even this makes Beirut look like a pretty good place to do business. And as they reached this conclusion, there was young Mohammed, not so young, middle-aged Mohammed bin Laden, who was a subcontractor on a lot of these jobs, who was building his own relationships with the Saudi royal family, there to say, "Look, I'll do it the way you want it done." And in effect was able to communicate both his flexibility about late payments, special jobs, private side deals, and then also to be able to mobilize and execute construction contracts very quickly when the Saudi royal family wanted things speeded up. And so from this beginning, he made himself indispensable. And I think the Saudi royal family took some pride in his entrepreneurial talent. He was able to muster great labor forces, bring them to jobs. He was an illiterate man with one eye, no engineering degree, but he had an intuitive feel for engineering problems that proved to be quite sound. And more important, he had the charisma to organize around him talent of all kinds, including engineers from Europe who knew how to execute the more complicated projects that he didn't personally have the capacity to do. And gradually he built these camps in the desert as he moved from one project to another, full of diverse workers and engineers and executives from all around the world. And many of them were Muslims from Africa or from South Asia or from elsewhere in the Arab world, Palestinians, Lebanese, Egyptians. Many were from Europe. Much of his executive team was Italian. And He had Americans working with him from the very beginning. He had an American agent on Broadway in New York from as early as the early 1950s, to help him import equipment. Now, he lived large as he gathered success, and inspired by the example of the Saudi royal family, he began to interpret the permission that Islamic law grants to a man to hold four wives simultaneously. He interpreted that in a way that was pioneered by the Saudi royal family, in which he generally kept one or two senior wives who stayed married to him for many, many years and bore five or six or seven children each, and then one or two wives he married and divorced in serial fashion, to the point where he ultimately had at least 22 wives and 54 children by those 22. Now, when one of his wives became pregnant, he recognized her legitimacy and fully recognized the legitimacy of the child that she bore, son or daughter, and enfranchised them as his heirs under Islamic law, as Islamic law required, because he was a very pious Muslim. He was a man who lived as best he could by Quranic precepts and law, and by their interpretation in Saudi Arabia. And so this meant that his children were entitled to a fixed share of his estate. They were entitled to fixed percentages of his business. And so far as the record shows, and I've looked at this quite closely because I think there's been a misimpression, for instance, that Osama was some kind of outcast, that his status was somehow distinct from other boys. I don't believe that's true at all. He was a fully enfranchised son. But his mother was one of the shorter-lived marriages, and a woman who was very young when Mohammed bin Laden at middle age took her in marriage from her rather poor Syrian family on the coast in a transaction that is shrouded but has the air of a very poor family giving up a very young daughter to a wealthy traveling businessman in consideration of employment, perhaps, for relatives or other. It's difficult to tell, but she was quite young, 15 or so, and she became pregnant, delivered Osama, and then Mohammed divorced her soon afterwards, but arranged for her remarriage to an executive in his own company, a man with a salary, and basically ensured that she would have a steady household and that Osama would grow up in such a household, as indeed he did, with stepbrothers and stepsisters born from the union of his mother and his new stepfather.
You're listening to Word for Word from American Public Media and a speech by Osama bin Laden biographer Steve Call.
So that was family life among the bin Ladens. There was a core compound where Mohammed and some of the more senior wives tended to live, but the sons gathered on weekends with their father in a typical Arabian sort of diwaniya style. They were given instruction. They would recite poetry to their father. They would memorize Quranic verses and recite them to him. He was a typical self-made parent in the sense that he wanted to impart to his children values that he believed had been crucial to his own success: frugality, humility, hard work, an ability to work with your hands, to work outside, to conquer the desert. And so he would gather his sons essentially as a camp counselor might to deliver these instructions and this teaching. Now, in his success, he also became crucially a modernizer. And though he spoke no language but Arabic, and rarely, to my knowledge, I'm not sure he ever traveled outside the Arab world, perhaps to Italy once or twice, he nonetheless wanted his sons to grow up in a much wider world than he had known. And in the Arabian tradition, he singled out his eldest son, Salim, for particular education in the coming world that he could see of international business as the oil economy in Saudi Arabia boomed. So he sent Salim to boarding school in England and put him in the care of trusted family retainers there. And he sent all of his sons to boarding school abroad or to an elite prep school in Jeddah to ensure that they had a modern education in the English language. And he also began to acquire the technologies of the 1960s era globalization of the jet age. He became the first private Saudi to own an airplane. And it was on that airplane in the southern deserts of Saudi Arabia on his way to a job site that his American pilot, while landing at a makeshift strip marked with rocks, miscalculated a crosswind and dropped to the earth with Muhammad aboard, crashed, burned, killing them both instantly on a September day in 1967. At the moment that Muhammad bin Laden died, leaving his 54 children behind, his eldest son was only in his early 20s, and he was living in London just having gotten out of boarding school. Now, Salem was a character who turned out to be as enthusiastic about the United States as his brother Osama would prove hostile to it, and he's a very difficult person to summarize. I can only say that as a researcher, I found him to be the gift that kept on giving. He was the most remarkable character I've ever tried to report about. He left behind many American and European friends who very much wanted him to be remembered in full, and their cooperation in my research was crucial to the vividness with which I was able to draw him. But when the curtain opens on Salem's inheritance as the eldest son, he is the unquestioned leader of the family, essentially a monarch over the bin Ladens, even though he's quite young. He's just come out of a prep school in southern England where he's played in a rock band called the Echoes. He smokes a pipe. It's the late 60s. He has a little sports car hidden outside the prep school grounds illegally, which he and his friends, Turkish and Iranian and English, take into London to try to go to Soho nightclubs. He is a performer. He loves to sing. And as he grows into the leadership of the bin Laden family, he's looking for any stage that he can sing on. He goes to a party at the Academy Awards in Los Angeles and pays the band leader $200 in order to sing House of the Rising Sun in seven languages. At every wedding, the wedding of Anwar Sadat's daughter, at Oktoberfest that he happens to randomly walk into in Munich, at any wedding that he's invited to attend, he takes the stage and leads the audience in not just rock songs, Beatles songs, House of the Rising Sun, but really corny songs like On Top of Old Smokey, When She's Coming Round the Corner, Where She's Coming Round the Corner When She Comes. And he uses this this way of living to do business because he takes over what's now a business that has many international partners, European corporations, Fortune 500 corporations. He will only conduct business meetings while lying in bed and watching television. And he brings the executives in. They have to sit at the foot of his bed and negotiate with him. Well, this puts him at 27 on somewhat equal footing with these distinguished chief executives. When the chief executive of Bell Canada flies into Saudi Arabia to cut what turns out to be the biggest foreign telephone contract that Bell Canada's had in a generation, in order to get it, they have to go to to Salem's house, where he forces the CEO to lead one portion of a three-pronged round of Frère Jacques for about 30 minutes. And he's an extraordinarily talented character who is a pilot. And he quickly acquires a collection of private aircraft, which he flies all over the world. He flies to Europe the way you or I might cross town. He goes to Paris one day, to London later in the afternoon. That next morning he wakes up and on a whim decides it's time to go shopping in New York. He spends an enormous amount of time in the United States, a place that he comes to love, which is to him just he's a very American character in a lot of ways, quite mobile, very egalitarian, has no time for snobs, hates Palm Beach, loves Panama City, Florida, which those of you who are not too proud to own it is known as the Redneck Riviera. And that's where he hangs out with his pilot friends. And they close down the local shopping mall anchored by Penny's and Dillard's, and they go in and buy all the pianos in the music stores that they can find and go back to the Bay Marriott and sing songs until 3 in the morning. He sees America as a great shopping center, and one of his favorite, he has an apartment in New York, and he loves going to 47th Street to buy electronics at a discount. And he basically takes great pride that he is a man who doesn't pay retail in New York. And he'll once he negotiates a price, he buys everything that the store owners have and orders it sent to his Bach 111 private jet at Kennedy, which he then flies back to Saudi Arabia and hands out all these Casio calculator video cameras to the princes, saying, "Oh, these are the latest thing in the United States." And so he becomes a kind of concierge service for a certain generation of the Saudi royal family. Young people like him growing up in an age of extraordinary opportunity because they have the money to travel and to purchase in the 70s and the 80s whatever identity you wish. And that famous photo of the family leaning on a pink Cadillac on vacation in Sweden in 1971, some of you may have seen. A large group of bin Ladens. Salim is not in the picture, but spiritually, that's him. And they look like the cast of that 70s show. That's Salim's world. Now, he was, as I say, he was a very egalitarian character. Once when he was at a dinner with a business partner, American business partner, and the bottle of wine was ordered. He didn't drink much, but liked champagne lightly. And a bottle of wine was ordered. And the businessman tasted it and sent it back as unsatisfactory. Salim saw this and sort of knocked the waiter around a little bit for bringing such a flawed bottle of wine. So Salim excused himself as if he were going to the men's room, and he went into the kitchen and he grabbed the waiter and he said, "Okay, give me that bottle, give me another bottle. Here's $100. Takes the new bottle, pours it out, takes the old bottle, pours it into the new bottle. Recorks it, says, "Okay, now go serve this." He serves it, and the businessman, of course, praises it as much improved and so forth. And Salim just calls him out and basically cuts all of their deal-making off. He would buy thousands of cases of Tabasco sauce and send them back. He was very fond. He observed the Saudi boycott of Coca-Cola, which was directed at U.S. foreign policy toward Israel. But he became enamored of a drink called Yahoo, which some sort of and Mellow Yellow, which he would buy the thousands of cases and send home. He used to buy armored Cadillacs in the United States for the royal family as well, as plants and cactuses and so forth for their palaces. But mostly he loved to fly. He was in the air all of the time, and he was a very talented pilot. He liked to fly recreationally. He flew himself everywhere he went. He acquired hot air balloons and flew those across the desert, and he particularly liked ultralights, recreational aircraft. And he would take these into the desert, not only in Saudi Arabia, where the royal family frowned upon such playcraft, but he would take them to Pakistan. And one of the most remarkable stories, which I sort of partially opened the book with, I've always been interested in what Americans Osama ever met, because first there was the question of whether he had dealt directly with the Central Intelligence Agency, and the answer to that is no, so far as I can tell from many years of prodigious digging around. He was one degree separated from CIA officers who worked with Afghans, who worked with Osama, but I don't believe he ever had any meetings with officers who were directly engaged with him. He was a Saudi client, not an American client. So I know he's met later with journalists, a couple of journalists, to give interviews, but I wondered what Americans he'd ever encountered. Well, one day I met a man named George Harrington, who is was a salesman of ultralight aircraft outside of San Antonio, Texas. And one day Salim walked into his store and bought all of the ultralights they had in stock, loaded them onto his private plane, and shipped them back to Saudi Arabia. Then he learned that George was a rock guitarist of some talent and said, "Well, look, I'm going on a hunting trip with Saudi princes in the Pakistani desert, and I want a hot air balloon and some ultralights. Why don't you come along, play guitar in my band, and you can arrange the ultralight flying for the Saudi princes?" Well, George had never been out of the United States before, but he showed up at the airport with his bags and gamely got on Salim's private jet. They flew to London. They flew to a ski resort in Austria, where they went into the discotheque of Adnan Khashoggi and played House of the Rising Sun on a New Year's Eve party together. Then they flew to Cairo. They flew to Dubai. They floated around in hot air balloons. They went to Pakistan, and the Pakistan army said, "You're out of your mind. We're at war. You're not bringing any ultralights or hot air gerbilins in here. So they ended up having to go out camping without them. But one day, Solomon came to George and said, oh, I got to go up to see my brother, get in the plane, we're flying to Peshawar. They flew up to Peshawar, landed on a dirt road in the 1980s, got out. Osama came out to greet them. And Solomon had a video camera and was videoing. They went and saw some orphans who sang some songs. And Solomon and Osama had a meeting, and Solomon brought Osama some money. He was a collaborator of Osama's in those days, even though they had entirely different lifestyles. And that ends up being a big thread of their relationship. So let's then reach Osama and consider him in light of his fealty and really his affection for Solomon. Because they really, the only Americans and Europeans that I can document that Osama ever met then were these shaggy-haired, chain-smoking, slightly hippie-inflected rock and roll entourage members of Solomon's international jet-set business piloting sort of world. And but he treated them all respectfully because any friend of Solomon's was a friend of his. And Solomon, because the Afghan war in those days, in the anti-Soviet days, was an authorized Saudi project, an entirely authorized Saudi project, and of course it was an authorized American project and was fully in alignment with American foreign policy, Solomon took it upon himself to make sure that Osama, who was essentially at the war as a representative of the bin Laden family and the bin Laden company, had what he needed. And at one point, Osama said that he wanted shoulder-fired missiles. And Solomon, through one of his German pilot rock and roll friends, made a connection to an arms dealer who was willing to acquire these missiles in South America. And they had Osama fly out to a luxury hotel in 1986 in London, where they put him up in a suite and they arranged for these brokers to come in. And one of the people in the meeting provides an account of it on the record in the book. And he describes Solomon essentially putting Osama in one suite. And then as they're walking in, he says to him, okay, he says, look, my brother is really, really religious. So no jokes. Treat me like a proper sheikh and put your cigarette out. We'll be out in 45 minutes. And that was the way they dealt with Osama and the way Osama dealt with them. Now, Osama grew up in this rather ordinary suburban household in Jeddah and was radicalized at prep school. He attended the finest prep school in Saudi Arabia at the time, a place where the boys wore blue blazers and gray flannel slacks. And he was recruited into an after-school study group by his Syrian gym teacher, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and indoctrinated into a very political form of Islam. But as I run out of time, I just want to sketch the ways in which I see Osama as a product of this family and as his father's son and as his brother's brothers. And there's just four things I want to mention. One is his talent as a leader of diversity. Osama is distinctive among Islamist leaders of all kinds, and certainly I think of terrorist leaders of all kinds, in the way that he has been able to attract and hold a big tent coalition of followers. Al-Qaeda in the late 1990s and today is an extraordinarily diverse community. He has attracted Filipinos and Indonesians and Africans and Moroccans and Algerians and Libyans and Palestinians and Europeans and even at least one prominent American. And he has been able, even though he's a Saudi, which is a culture remarked upon correctly for its strains of xenophobia, he's been able to do this without providing any hint of discrimination on the basis of language group, national origin, ethnicity, race. And he even downplays serious sectarian divides, such as the Sunni-Shia divide, in service of this great community unified by the imagined community of Islam, imagined not because I refute its claim to theological truth, but because it is a place outside of states, outside of map lines on the map. It is an attempt to reimagine a community that, in Osama's view, history has obliterated unjustly. And so there is, I think, a direct inspiration in the pattern of his father's genius and in the pattern of his father's leadership, this extraordinary charisma and ability to manage diversity, both manage it down and manage it up. The second important way that Osama bin Laden is in his use of technology and his characteristics as a modernizer. His greatest innovation as a terrorist was the use of satellite telephones to attack two U.S. embassies in Africa simultaneously while never leaving Afghanistan. And this was in 1998. And at the time that he undertook this operation, had the imagination to conceive it and execute it over a period of years, his family, the family that had repudiated him in Saudi Arabia at that time, were the leading investors in the Middle East in Iridium, the first satellite phone company, failed, but the first to visualize a phone that you could carry anywhere and use in any country. They just had the wrong technology, satellites as against cellular. He's also a bin Laden in his innovations as a marketer, because he went to business school and he's built a brand. And he's done that, I think, very self-consciously through videos and through his brother's videoing and fundraising operations. And then finally, he's a performer. And sometimes when I watch him in his own sort of twisted, violent way before the cameras, rushing back to the cameras, even when it's really against his interest as a fugitive to do so, but seemingly provoked by something that President Bush has said that he's been watching on satellite television. Now when I see him in his gold robes and his vein-dyed beard, I can't help but think of his half-brother on the stage singing House of the Rising Sun in seven languages. Thank you very much for your attention.
Steve Gall, author of The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. He spoke in mid-April at the Commonwealth Club of California. After his initial remarks, Call took questions from the Commonwealth audience in San Francisco and moderator Andrew Ross of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Where is he? Where is Osama? What is he up to? And when will he be caught?
I think he's almost certainly in Pakistan. What he's up to is transparent because he continues to make and distribute video and audio tapes in which he attempts to describe his own role as the narrator of a war that he imagines himself leading. And what he's up to as an operator is less clear, but Al-Qaeda, the organization that he continues to head, has reconstituted itself along the Afghan border and is carrying out violent conspiracies in Europe, most significant of which is being described right now and on trial in Britain, the attempt to blow up planes over the Atlantic. This was the conspiracy that led to us not being able to take our toothpaste on carry-ons anymore. And as I presume Osama has a role in those plots, but probably isn't the main sort of mechanic or organizer. I have this, as to exactly where he is, we have this sort of parlor game with other Al-Qaeda nerds, as I prefer to call us, where suppose somebody comes in right now and says he's been caught or he's been killed, but doesn't tell you, but you say, okay, don't tell me where. And then you put a map up on the wall and everybody takes a pin and closest to the hole wins. You know, where would you put your pin is the question. And I would put my pin, I think, although I've been argued out of one or two places within about 100 miles of each other. One would be a town called Miran Shah in North Waziristan, and the other is an adjacent federally administered tribal area called Bajur. You can make a case for both of them. Most of the people I know know what they're talking about say they'd put their pin in one of those two places. Doesn't mean he's there, but that's, I think, where the best evidence is. Finally, will he be caught? I wrote a piece in the LA Times arguing not that he will be caught or trying to predict such a thing, which is impossible to forecast, but just arguing that it's more likely that he'll be caught in the next year or two than at any time since December 2001. And the reason is that his popularity in Pakistan has declined dramatically over the last year or so, because he's seen as inspiring a local campaign of suicide bombings that Pakistanis are rejecting. And so his approval rating, as measured by reliable polling, has really collapsed. These hunts of similar fugitives in Pakistan have almost always ended when somebody drops a dime on the fugitive in order to pick up the reward money or to achieve some other goal. So now that seems more likely. And also, for more complicated reasons that I won't dwell upon, I think the new democratic government in Pakistan has a better motivational set to actually find him than the authoritarian government before them, led by President Musharraf.
If Osama follows in the footsteps of his father and older brother, as you suggested, what caused his divergence and extremism? And a related question is, what really was it that set Osama off?
Well, it's obviously an important question, and in human affairs, it would be unusual for there to be a single answer to that question. But and it's also a subject about which his own family continues to speculate. Probably the most important factor is lying in plain sight, which is the people and the ideas and the experiences that Osama came upon on the frontier in Afghanistan as a self-declared jihadi fighter. I think his modernity and his sophistication as a tactician and as a politician coexist with essentially millenarian fantasy radicalism that was mentored and reinforced by the experience of war and the fighting of war in Afghanistan. But he also, there are strains of personal decision-making and identity available in the record. I try to be very cautious about not over-interpreting the evidence that's there, but just drawing attention to it. And I do wish, sometimes I'm asked, what would I ask Osama if I had the chance to interview him if he were to join us here on the panel? I would be, as a biographer, anxious to encourage him to say more than he ever has about his own narrative, because he's really silent about his family and about his ambition within the family. But it leaks out in his writing and his statements and in his poetry and in lots of other places. And it's, you don't have to interpret it very hard to see it there, but it's just, it just kind of falls out in clumps. And it's very difficult to understand what it feels like to him. But I think he did have ambition to run his family. I think he did have ambition to run his company. I think he saw himself as a potential leader of Saudi Arabia in partnership with a more righteous, more Islamic Saudi royal family. And I think part of the reason that he hesitated to go all the way for a long while was that he was hoping that some political change would occur in Saudi Arabia that would essentially invite him home as the righteous leader of his own family and its partnership with the al-Saud.
Steve Call, author of The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century, speaking recently at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
The money question, he's said to be worth, figure here from the audience's member, is $350 million. How much was, I guess, generated by the family, and why has this money not been funded and seized? A questioner wants to know. Why has the family not been held financially accountable?
Yeah, good question. $300 million was the fortune attributed to Osama by the Central Intelligence Agency in reporting to two presidents right up to 9/11, and it was wildly wrong. When I first started to dig around in the United States for records that would allow some insight into the specificity of the inheritance and the allowances and the system of family money, the first discovery I made was in a basement of the Los Angeles County Superior Court, where there was an archived divorce case involving one of Osama's brothers dating to 1991, and his Armenian-American ex-wife had decided that what her ex-husband was telling her about the family allowances and the size of the inheritance just didn't sound right to her, so she hired, through her attorneys, a forensic accountant who traveled to Saudi Arabia in 1991 and essentially came back with an accurate portrait of the family finances, which put the inheritance at the time of Muhammad's death, when it was later distributed by his elder brother, in the $10 to $18 million range. And the annual allowances, tax-free in the 70s, about $300,000 base, more if you had a salary in the company, but far different from the $300 million fortune. And what was discouraging as a taxpayer myself was to find this sitting in an open record in LA County Superior Court, available 10 years before 9/11, But the intelligence reporting was derived from rumors, essentially, in Saudi Arabia that inflated all of these numbers and attributed to Osama a fortune that was at least 10 times greater than what he possessed. And the reason this mattered was that it suggested, in contrast to this reporting, that he was not self-financing. He was, in fact, like a nonprofit, raising money on an annual basis, driving annual giving, and he needed each year to renew his commitments. And then to be able to break that down would be to get inside his operations, and also would be a path to disruption. So it was a consequential mistake, but it was a rather grand one in scale.
And could or should the U.S. government try and...
Oh, it's very interesting. He was forced by the U.S. government... it's a thread in the book, and you'll see it reported out from soup to nuts, this question of the U.S. government's thinking about the bin Laden family, their relationship with Osama, their consideration of all their attempts to get the family to cooperate during their investigations, the overhang of possible sanctions as a remedy if they were dissatisfied, the way the bin Ladens acquired their own attorneys to represent their interests in the United States, and all of that is an element of the narrative. But the family defends itself by referring to its divestment of Osama from the two major companies in which he held shares at a certain point when his radicalism became too much. And they've submitted to a federal court in cases involving the victims of 9/11, cases that are still in litigation, documents that they assert prove that Osama did in fact sell out his shares, and they disclosed that he was paid $10 million for those shares in 1994, and that money was held in a special trust account for him in Saudi Arabia, not so much for his prospective reconciliation, but under Islamic law, his heirs would not be punished for his sort of political sins, in effect, in this trust system. But how this actually worked is the subject of continuing litigation in the United States, about which I'm very curious.
Staying with the American side of the story, a question from the audience. Looking at the state of the country, the United States, now, did bin Laden win?
No, he didn't. He sought to create a revolution in the world's affairs, one that would bring to power Islamic governments, and one in which the United States would collapse the way the Soviet Union collapsed. He caused a great deal of damage to the United States and to the international system, but he didn't win the war that he still believes he's fighting. In fact, he believes he's still at war, and one of the consequences of our overuse of the war metaphor in contest with him is that it actually feeds into the narrative that he prefers. He sees himself not just fighting a political war, but fighting a millenarian war ordained by God that will only end on Judgment Day, and to which he has been called as a special leader. And when he sometimes sounds like an ordinary political commentator on Al Jazeera talking about grievances from the here and now and this cause and that cause and ripped from the headlines, and that's a legitimate aspect of his political speech. He is a politician in that respect, but he is also a millenarian who believes that only the conversion of all human souls to Islam is victory. I mean, he says that at the same time. And one of the frustrating things about reading his speeches and documents, if you choose to make a project of it, is that he'll tack back and forth between these modalities without pausing to write a transition. It's just all of a piece to him.
What three priorities should the next president set to win the war on terror, or perhaps to do better against bin Ladenism?
Well, I'll try to narrow that question using the prerogative of the speaker, because I think the next president is going to inherit an equation in Iraq that is going to dominate all foreign policy decision-making, at least for a time. And so that's really the answer to the question, but I think I'll choose to interpret it as directed more toward al-Qaeda and Bin Laden. And I do think that there are a number of both sort of strategic and tactical changes to the way the United States attempts to pressure and contain and defeat al-Qaeda that would be recommended. And just to take one that I referred to before, I think it's important to change the narrative, to deprive Osama of his own narrative, and to disaggregate, if that's not too crude a term, the terrorists that he tries to aggregate as a righteous global movement. And that means isolating and breaking down in national contexts those who commit violence in his name or for any other reason. And it doesn't mean abandoning the use of military force in all instances, but it does mean rebalancing the campaign against al-Qaeda so that it is less a matter of mechanized military units and more a matter of total capacity that the United States can bring to bear. And that means being smarter about his media strategy. It means being smarter about his patterns of recruitment. And it means also, finally, capturing him or killing him and bringing him to justice. Because as long as he is out there telling his own story, then al-Qaeda, the organization and the movement, has a continuity that it does, I think, draw some strength from.
Steve Call, speaking April 15th at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco about his new book, The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. Call won a Pulitzer Prize for his 2004 book, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a former reporter and managing editor at The Washington Post. These days, he is president of the New America Foundation, a public policy institute. If you missed part of this hour's speech by Steve Call, or if you would like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. When you get there, you can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and take part in an online discussion about the ideas in this hour's program, as well as the ideas in previous programs. You can also search our archives and listen to speakers such as CNN correspondent Christiane Amanpour, journalist and fiasco author Thomas Ricks, and Joseph Nye, who talks about hard and soft power. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.